who have paid for similar services in the past, and based on what you know they have provided for previous clients. But you should also go further. Start to understand that often there will be a number of factors influencing how far someone will go on a particular issue. Maybe they are under pressure from a third party. Maybe they have a tough deadline that is driving them to do this deal in a certain way. Maybe their cash flow is so poor it is influencing the rates they will work for. Maybe they are an avid collector and so would pay over the publicised market value to secure a certain product. Maybe they are looking to exit a certain market. Maybe they just want to close this deal quickly as they are going on their honeymoon in 2 days' time. Maybe they are trying to impress a new boss. You get the idea. Any number of factors could be influencing what they might be willing to agree to and where they have set their breakpoint. Your job is not to assume that you automatically know their breakpoint, but instead to adopt a curious mindset and explore how the world looks to them. So, for each issue, you need to set your breakpoint. Think creatively about what their breakpoint might be. You can then go on to thinking about the possible boundaries of the deal and look at the negotiation zone. There are lots of different names given to the field in which a potential deal could be done. Zone of potential agreement, bargaining range, trading zone. I am simply going to refer to it as the negotiation zone. The point of establishing this zone and mapping it out is to understand where you need to be steering the negotiation once you get to the deal table. The negotiation zone represents the point at which it's possible for a deal to be done. It is the point between each party's breakpoint on each issue, in which a deal would be acceptable to either side. For the sake of simplicity, let's look at just one variable, say cost or price. Let's imagine that the buyer's breakpoint has been set at £14. As a buyer, this represents the highest you could possibly go on this point. After careful consideration and research, you, as the buyer, have decided that you think the seller's breakpoint is £10. This will represent the lowest amount that the seller could possibly accept. You need to remember that this is simply an educated guess. In the next phase, we will explore why opening ambitiously is a good way of testing just how accurate you were in establishing the other party's breakpoint. Of course, the aim of the game is to try to get the best possible outcome. As a result, you are going to try to finish closer to their breakpoint than to your own. A deal closer to £10 would be a better outcome for you as the buyer than it would be for the seller. By doing this, you will have been able to maximise the available negotiation zone. Other key reference points around the negotiation zone are your ambitious opener, your starting proposal, and the get real point, the area beyond each party's breakpoint where a deal simply isn't possible. Both of these points have been explored in Chapter 2 and will be revisited again in the Ask section of the Deals Method, Chapter 5. When you are in a negotiation with multiple issues, it is often helpful to produce an overall map of the various breakpoints. This can act as a point of reference both before and during the negotiation. It will also allow you oversight of all the possibilities in the deal. It is key that you have understood all of the issues fully, so you are going to have to analyse the breakpoints for each issue, even if there are hundreds of them. If you don't do this, you are never going to fully understand where you might be able to get to in this deal, and you could end up leaving bucket loads of value behind because you haven't utilised the less obvious issues. What is the alternative? As a final step in the establish phase, you should fully consider what your alternatives are if you can't reach an agreement in the forthcoming negotiation. Do you have other options? Could you get the product somewhere else? Is your service in demand elsewhere? Can you afford to wait for another opportunity? For more on understanding your best alternative to negotiated agreement, BATNA, take a look at Chapter 8 on the balance of power. Whether or not you have credible and robust alternatives can make a huge difference to how you conduct a negotiation and how much power you really have at your disposal. Before you move on, stop to reflect. Have you seen the world through their eyes? Have you exchanged relevant information? Have you established your takes and gives? Have you worked out each side's breakpoints on all of the possible trading issues? Chapter 5. Ask. The next phase of the deals method is to assert yourself and ask, in the right way. This phase is primarily concerned with our conduct and behaviour during the negotiation. But before we get anywhere near the bargaining table, we are going to start by planning some proposals, or our asks. As I have said already, winging it is never a smart negotiation strategy. It is not sensible to turn up at the negotiation table and make it up as you go along. The chances are you will end up simply being led by the other side and constantly reacting to the proposals they make to you. Failing that, your mind will go blank and you will end up suggesting proposals that are really not that great once you pick apart the deal later on. I routinely see even the most intelligent people lose their way in negotiations where they haven't prepared properly. It's a clever approach to have already planned a number of proposals before you get to the negotiation. All of the previous phases of the deals method will have now delivered you to the point where you have more than enough information to start preparing some robust and insightful proposals. Proactive versus reactive. The starting point for this section is to challenge what is a very commonly held concept for many people. On training programs and during coaching, when I advise people to plan some proposals in advance, a common pushback is, "But how can I do that when I don't know what they are going to propose to me?" Without wishing to sound brutal, negotiation is not about you passively waiting to hear what their proposals might be. It is about you being smart enough to understand that their proposals are merely going to be exaggerated versions of what works for them. What you don't want to do is anchor to their proposals or get bogged down in them, which, if you haven't planned your own proposals in advance, you will inevitably do. So, do yourself a favour, research effectively, plan properly, and get some proposals written before you get anywhere near that negotiation. Look, you might not use all of them. You might use one or two and skip a couple. But by having them there, at least you have options and a possible route through the negotiation. This will be a lifesaver when the pressure is on and your nerves are going haywire. If you, then I. When you are planning your proposals, you need to embrace, and I mean fully embrace, the construction if you, then I. Earlier in the book, I introduced the idea that this phrase is our saviour in preventing us from giving things away for free. By constructing our proposals in this way, we ensure that we are always getting something back in return. We are not just giving and giving and giving. In the previous phase, we identified which of the issues in a negotiation were takes and which were gives. We also worked out what the breakpoints were for each party on each of the issues. It is now time to put this pre-work to good use. Using the list of gives and takes and taking on board the breakpoints for each issue, you should start to pair up which issues will form part of your proposals. Using this approach, you are going to be asking for your take and then offering your give in return. The message? I am more than happy to help you achieve what you need, but I'm going to have to see that you are willing to help me too. You are going to have to work for this reward. One of the biggest obstacles that I witness at this point is that people get way too bogged down in overthinking what take they should pair with what give. They overanalyze what should go with what. But in truth, for the first few proposals, it doesn't really matter that much. A multi-issue deal should be viewed as one in which you are trying to unlock as much total value and opportunity as possible. It also illustrates that total value is only accessible when you view all of the variables as integral to the deal, and when you explore each variable's potential trading options. This means that you should avoid working in the silo mentality of always pairing the same issues each time. If you adopt this very traditional mentality, you will find that while you are able to agree on a number of initial points, as the deal unfolds, you will find yourself being left with the more difficult, complex, and controversial issues that you are always going to struggle to reach an agreement on. When this occurs, if you deem that the other issues have already been agreed and are off the table, then you have limited options when it comes to levering an agreement on the more controversial matters. If you can't bring those agreed issues back onto the table for review and an alternative agreement, then you end up swinging back to a hard bargaining mentality. And then you are most certainly limiting the deal you can do, as the interaction will start to feel more like a battle. Instead, you need to retrain your brain to see the deal in its entirety, look across all of the issues and view each one as being potentially linked to any of the others. I call this pick and mix trading, where you can pair any of the issues together to try to maximise the value associated with each of them. Having talked about all of the work we have to do before we get to the negotiation table, the following tips are designed to help you with making the ask once you are in the negotiation. Don't get bogged down by reactionary responses. One of the things that you need to do is ensure that every move you make is not just a direct response to what they have proposed to you. Say, for example, that they propose, "If you can pay £500, then we can guarantee the product by next Wednesday." Do not be tempted to then focus on discussing this until you have thrashed out an agreement on just those two issues. This is particularly true if you actually have no intention of ever accepting the proposal. If you spend too much time responding to their proposal, you are merely anchoring yourself to what they have asked for. Instead, follow your plan. Suggest an alternative proposal that you have drafted in advance. You might want to think about phrases such as, "Thanks for that suggestion. That's not something we could agree to, but what we could agree to is..." And make them feel heard. As we have already identified, people like to feel heard. They want their opinions and suggestions to be taken seriously. They don't want to have their ideas dismissed outright. So, you can help soften the fact that you are moving on from their proposal to making your own by making sure that any proposal you make builds on what they just asked for. If you have followed the phases of the deals method, you should have a compendium of potential options for proposals right at your fingertips. It should, therefore, be relatively easy for you to respond to their proposal by acknowledging some of the points made, while still ensuring you are presenting proposals that meet your objectives. So how would this work in practice? Imagine that your counterparty makes the offer we just mentioned. "If you can pay £500, then we can guarantee the product by next Wednesday." You should then look at your tools, select a pre-planned proposal based on one of the points they made, or select relevant issues from the breakpoint mapper and respond with, "Thanks for that proposal. Looking at the bigger picture, we would struggle with that, but I like the idea of working towards Wednesday. So how about, if you can guarantee delivery by Wednesday, we could offer you £440 and a written testimonial." This way, you are able to use their proposal as a foundation for your response, but you are still talking about what you want while politely moving on from their suggestion. This whole approach requires flexibility. To be able to do this, you will have to have understood all of the different issues and where you might be able to go on them well in advance. So don't skimp on the proposals you prepare in advance. You might not use all of them, but to have a number of options in front of you that you can use, modify or come back to is incredibly empowering. Back pocket strategy. Of course, in any multi-issue negotiation, there may be certain points that you want to get out on the table early and others that you might want to hang on to for greater impact later on. If you are going to do this, it's essential that you highlight which issues will warrant special treatment early on in this proposal drafting stage, and make sure that anyone you are negotiating alongside or for is clear on why you are adopting this strategy. Don't offer it all at once. When making your proposals, make sure that you don't offer the maximum on each issue immediately. Make them work for it. That way you can ensure you have got everything you need before you give up everything you have to trade with. When constructing your proposals, you should initially ask big and offer small. That way you can make the other party feel like they are winning when later in the negotiation you offer something bigger on that issue than you did initially. Get real. Of course, you have to be mindful of the get real point when making your initial proposals. Don't open so ambitiously that your proposal is ridiculous or unrealistic. This is particularly true if trust and collaboration will be key components of any future agreement. There is a difference between ambitious and outlandish. Use timeouts if you lose focus. If things start to get muddled, you have lost track of your position, or you have simply run out of proposals and have found yourself becoming too reactionary or winging it, a good tactic is to call a timeout. Negotiations are often tense, stressful, and demanding, even in the most collaborative of situations. A timeout can be a great way for you and any team members to take a deep breath, review where you have got to, and plan where you want to go next. A timeout is not a sign of weakness. You should view it as an informed gap in the proceedings for both you and your counterparty to make sure you are on course for an agreement. If you have followed all of the phases in the deals method before you get to the negotiation, planning some new proposals in the timeout should be as simple as reviewing your tools and, based on your progress, drafting some new if-you-then-I statements to guide you through the next part of the meeting. Remember, try to go first if you can. We have already discussed in some detail the importance of anchoring and making the first proposal. The evidence behind going first is plentiful, compelling, and should not be ignored. If you can make the first proposal, then you should try to. Do be aware that your counterparty might try sneakily to use anchoring by sending you their opening proposal in advance. If this does happen, simply make sure that you are not too swayed by what their proposal contains. Review it, make a note, but stick to your pre-prepared plan of proposals while using their opening proposal for some insight into how they might be approaching the wider negotiation. Remember, their opening proposal is simply an exaggerated version of what works for them from their perspective. Don't let that impact your plan, unless you spot something that you hadn't anticipated which works in your favour. If that's the case, take a moment to wonder why the deal might be too good to be true, or scold yourself for having not preempted it. Remember the concept of predictable surprises. Prepare for going second. Of course, you might be in a negotiation where industry ritual or process demands that your counterparty go first, or they might simply get in there straight away with the first proposal. In this instance, don't panic. The negotiation isn't doomed to fail because they have made the first move. Instead, recognise the power of anchoring and the potential impact of making the first offer. Then make sure that you don't reinforce it by making the mistakes highlighted in Chapter 2, especially don't dwell on it. Don't argue about it. Don't ask them to explain themselves. Instead, you should simply acknowledge the offer, thank them for it, and move on. Then start talking about what you can do. Cast out a new anchor. Make your proposal the response. Let's recap before you move on. Have you adopted a proactive rather than a reactive mindset when it comes to making your ask? Planned using the if you, then I mantra? Utilised all of the different issues when constructing your proposals? Thought about how to deal with anchoring? Been mindful of the get real point? Planned to open ambitiously and first? Chapter 6. Lead. This next phase is concerned purely with the negotiation itself. Or, more importantly, with whether we are controlling the negotiation or letting it control us. The impact of your previous mapping, planning, and plotting could be severely reduced if you do not take the lead in the negotiation. Taking the lead means being in control, executing the deal brilliantly, managing the negotiation, managing any team members with you, managing the environment, but also managing yourself. What we say and what we do. We have already talked about the fact that many people find negotiation pretty tough. Sure, there are some people who really love the whole process, but many others will find it awkward, difficult, and a real challenge. It's no secret that when human beings experience stress, nerves, or anxiety, we become flooded with adrenaline. Our heart beats faster, our guts churn, our breathing quickens, and we generally feel on edge. Our fight-or-flight mentality will shape how we respond to the people around us. All of this will begin to have an impact on how we start to interact and communicate with others. Often, the best way to see what someone is thinking about something is to listen and watch for the things they say and the things they do. Of course, many people are aware of this response and will invest time and money in learning how to mask their nerve, stress, anxiety, fear, or anger. There are some people out there who are incredibly skilled at presenting the appropriate mask or performance. An obvious example is professional poker players, for whom the ability to maintain calm in a high-stakes environment is of fundamental importance to their success. But not everyone is a professional poker player. Not everyone is skilled at controlling the verbal and non-verbal messages they give out. On our training programs, my team and I use video technology to show people how easy they are to read in a high-pressure negotiation. Of course, we also show them how to read the same kinds of messages coming from their counterparty. The point is, you need to make sure that you are in control of your whole self during a negotiation. You need to be conscious of the language you are using and the message it's really sending, as well as being in control of your physical tells and giveaways. Controlling your physical tells. Use breathing to calm yourself. Count to five in your mind before answering a challenging question. Try to speak more slowly. Use firm language. Be conscious of your movements. Don't fiddle and fidget. Feel grounded by planting both feet on the floor. Sit tall. Agenda. A really simple way of making sure that you retain an element of control and are able to lead a negotiation is to suggest the use of agendas, both in the run-up to and during the negotiation. This could cover everything from what will be discussed in any pre-meets through to where the negotiation will take place, how long it will last, and who will be present and in what capacity. By sharing this beforehand and developing it together, each side feels involved and engaged in the process. This also gives you a great get-out clause if they spring something unexpected on you during the negotiation or seek to change the rules of engagement. If both sides have been working to a shared agenda and your counterparty throws an unforeseen issue or rule into the mix, you can politely and professionally say, "We prepared for this meeting on the basis of the agenda we jointly developed. Because this wasn't raised earlier in the process, we haven't considered it. I would like to be able to give this my full attention and request a time out in order for us to explore the issue further, both with you and as a team." Capture the deal. In a multi-issue deal, managing complexity and tracking your progress on areas of agreement as the deal unfolds can be a real challenge. One of the easiest ways to keep track of the negotiation and to make sure that all issues are being effectively utilised is to use a deal sheet. A tool such as the deal sheet is incredibly simple yet powerful, as it allows you to capture the progress being made and to identify areas where you might be stalling or where you simply haven't prepared enough proposals. It is also useful in that it prevents you from slipping back into the silo mentality, always pairing the same issues each time instead of adopting a flexible pick-and-mix approach. The deal sheet works by capturing every proposal that is made against every issue. There is no way of tracking which issue is paired with what each time. Instead, what you see as the negotiation progresses is a simple visual of the areas where you appear to be in agreement and also those areas where you still have distance between you. It provides you with real-time data on each issue, and because it gathers all the issues together, you can consider the deal in its entirety. You start to move away from focusing only on the obvious issues. This is essential, as it means that you limit the chance of leaving any value behind. You are able to see which issues could still be used to stimulate progression or agreement, and you are also able to see whether you have got a great deal overall. One of the dangers of not negotiating in this way is that you focus on securing agreement on the big, high-profile items first. So, for example, you might target getting an agreement early on in relation to pricing. After a bit of to-ing and fro-ing on a couple of issues, you finally agree on what looks to be a pretty good deal for you. However, As the rest of the deal unfolds, you find that because some of your most important issues have been put aside as agreed, you have less to use as a lever. You remain upbeat, though, because you have a good outcome on pricing. You trundle through the rest of the deal, and after shaking hands, you retreat to examine the outcome. It's only upon reviewing the deal in its entirety that you realise you have got a good outcome on price at the cost of a shorter contract, a lengthy wait for your invoices to be paid, excessive expectations on seniority of personnel, and a restrictive exclusivity clause. All of a sudden, that agreement on pricing doesn't seem so attractive after all. Instead of this, start to think in terms of overall value. All of the issues in negotiation should be viewed as interwoven. Adopting a complete package or pick-and-mix approach, rather than addressing issues in isolation, will help you both to protect yourself and to wring as much value out of the deal as possible. Nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. To assist you with adopting the complete package approach, you should heed the mantra frequently used in international trade and diplomacy negotiations: nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. This mantra is all about ensuring that each side understands that the deal needs to be agreed in its entirety before any final sign-off. Sometimes you will find yourself negotiating with someone who frequently interjects when you are making proposals, with something like, "Hang on a minute, I thought we had agreed on a deadline of November for this project. You mentioned earlier on that we would get 10 people on the project, and now you are saying 9. A simple response to someone who seems intent on swinging the deal back round the silo approach is to suggest that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. This will help to diffuse any possible he said, she said, or bickering about people having misunderstood each other. The holding pen. In addition to this mantra, one of the ways to ensure that the negotiation can progress and unfold without getting bogged down in complexity is to agree issues in principle throughout the interaction. One of the tools that my team uses is the holding pen, a virtual space off the table where issues agreed in principle can be parked in order to ease congestion in the ongoing negotiation. So, if you have reviewed your deal sheet during a timeout and have seen that both sides seem to be proposing something similar on a number of issues, upon re-entering the negotiation, you could say something like, "We had a look at where we have got to so far, and we can see that we appear to be speaking the same language on issues A, B, C, and D. As a result, we would suggest that we place those issues in the holding pen for now as agreed in principle, but subject to agreement on all of the other issues. Of course, if we find we are struggling later on, we can always bring those issues back out of the holding pen and review them." The holding pen could be a completely abstract and intangible concept, or you could decide to use a flip chart populated with post-it notes of the issues. I would advise that you suggest the use of the holding pen well before you get into the nitty-gritty of the deal. That way you can embed a shared understanding of why it would be useful for both sides. Discipline in the team. If you are negotiating as part of a team, one of the most important things to do is to make sure that everyone in the team is clear on their role, what is expected of them, and what they can and cannot do. It is not uncommon to see the members of a negotiating team undermine themselves by talking over each other, unwittingly contradicting each other, or even making things up as they go along. Of course, if you are negotiating against well-trained professionals, they will notice this and take it as a sign that you are not a cohesive and unified team. As a result, they may try to encourage loose tongues, single out weaker team members, or just confuse you further by challenging what the team is actually asking for. Protect yourself from this kind of unruliness by assigning roles to your team members before you get to the negotiation. You might want to consider assigning someone as the communicator to deliver the pre-planned proposals, someone as the analyst to fill out the deal sheet and plan possible proposals, someone as the interpreter to read the other side, listening carefully for clues and insight, and supporting the analyst in seeing how the deal is unfolding, And finally, someone as the diplomat to manage climate control, making introductions, smoothing over difficult issues, and keeping the room focused and positive. Ultimately, the diplomat should also be empowered to make decisions on behalf of the group. Team roles. Communicator. Acts as the spokesperson for the group, delivers the pre-planned proposals clearly and succinctly. Analyst. Uses the deal sheet to record the deal as it unfolds, has a full understanding of the breakpoints, and is able to plan new proposals. Interpreter. Monitors the people in the room, reads signals and listens for clues, supports the analyst by interpreting how the deal is unfolding, and suggests alternative proposals to keep the team on track. Diplomat. Keeps the negotiation moving, manages the climate in the room, smoothing over negativity and barriers, is empowered to commit to the deal at the end. Climate control and the diplomat. In a high-pressure, multi-issue negotiation, there are bound to be tensions, differences of opinion, and sticky areas where agreement seems challenging. This is true in even the most solid of relationships and collaborative of approaches. If there is a relationship to be maintained post-agreement, or if you simply are of the view that a more collaborative approach will be more beneficial than an aggressive one, it makes sense to assign someone in the team to regulate the room's climate. At the start of the interaction, this person should ensure that introductions are made and that everyone is comfortable and has what they need. The diplomat should also make some kind of opening statement in relation to the intention of each side to reach a productive agreement. They should take responsibility for ensuring that roles are observed within their team and for managing fraying tempers or situations where people are becoming stuck on difficult issues. There is a famous expression that any diplomat would benefit from bearing in mind: the iron hand in the velvet glove. The thrust of the expression is that you can be tough and firm on the issues, the iron hand, but you need to remain warm and soft on the people if you are trying to maintain a relationship, the velvet glove. As the person managing the climate, it is your job to remain tough and focused on the issues throughout the negotiation, but also to preserve and even advance the relationship. To help you with this, pull together a bank of statements that could help the negotiation to progress should you face difficult issues that drag each side away from agreement. We call these words that soothe and phrases that move. An example of good climate control could be, "We are making great strides here, and I feel like we are getting closer to consensus on a number of really important points. As there appear to be some strong views here, how about we take a breather on this one for now and come back to it after we've had a look at some of the issues we haven't yet addressed?" The first part includes the words that soothe. You are reminding people how much has been achieved and that agreement is not far off. The second part is a phrase that moves, by suggesting that you look at alternative issues before coming back to the point of disagreement. You can diffuse any growing tension and clear the air before returning to it, hopefully with fresh eyes all round. Progress summaries. If you are negotiating a particularly complex deal with lots of different issues, it can be incredibly easy for the parties around the table to become confused, misunderstand each other, and lose track of where they have got to in the negotiation. A simple way to limit the risk of this happening and potentially derailing the negotiation is to use progress summaries throughout. This allows the parties to review what has been agreed in principle and what still needs to be addressed, and to identify areas where there appears to be a sticking point, so that each side can start to come up with ways to overcome it in their next proposals. The deal sheet can be used to help with this, as it provides an at-a-glance summary of where you are on each of the issues from each side's perspective. This can help you plan the direction of your next proposals more effectively. In addition, regular summaries can help to protect the deal from tumbling all the way back to the beginning because of mistakes or misinterpretation. I have heard about numerous deals that fell through because of a misunderstanding that was embedded into the deal in the early stages and that only became apparent right at the end when the deal was being summarised. tick-tock. If you are to remain in control and take the lead in your negotiation, it is essential that you're aware of one of the most commonly used tactics in negotiation, the manipulation of time. How often have you gone into a meeting only to be told that the planned 50 minutes has to be condensed to 20 minutes, but that you still need to get a deal done today? Or that you only have 24 hours to give your response to a complex proposal? Or that an important negotiation has moved, such that you only have 48 hours to prepare rather than a week? Or that an important negotiation has been delayed and delayed, and you are under a pressing deadline on the issue from another source? Or that if you don't agree to your counterparty's proposal in the next 5 minutes, they're going to go talk to an alternative supplier who is ready to do a deal? Time is a strange thing. For something so universally regulated, it has a strange habit of appearing to speed up or slow down when we least want it to. You can probably remember a date that seemed to pass agonizingly slowly when you realized that you really didn't like the person and just wanted it to end, or the two-week holiday of a lifetime that seemed to fly by in a flash when you desperately hoped it would never end. It is often said that nothing focuses the mind like a looming deadline. In fact, one of the things I have observed in many different negotiation settings is that when the clock is ticking, people often focus too much on their fear of failure or of deadlocking. It is this fear that often results in people agreeing to things that they would never normally agree to. In the heat of the moment, with your counterparty saying, "Come on, we don't have long, we do a deal today or not at all," the pressure to just say yes can be overwhelming. Similarly, if you haven't been given enough time to research and understand the issues in a negotiation, many people would rather be swept along and agree to something that sounds okay on the surface, rather than halt proceedings and say, "You know what? I don't think I'm happy with this. I need more time to review the information." Be aware of time. Keep a track of it. Challenge reductions in time made available to you. Question and resist excessive delays. Ask why a deadline has been set and query whether there could be flexibility. In short, be in control of the time rather than letting it take control of you. Have a strategy for dealing with challenging behaviour. One of the biggest obstacles to remaining calm and in control in a negotiation is other people's challenging behaviour. I'm talking about the negotiator who talks over you, is rude, is overly aggressive, invades your personal space, constantly rejects your proposals without offering alternatives, uses threats. All of these examples can be hugely intimidating during a negotiation, and if unanticipated can come as a huge shock to you if you had been planning on adopting a collaborative and professional approach. You can have prepared diligently, planned plenty of proposals, and fully briefed your team, but all of that can amount to nothing if you are derailed or upset by these kinds of behaviours. I would like to be able to tell you that these kinds of behaviours aren't used regularly, but unfortunately they are, and often as part of a very deliberate and pre-planned strategy. In 95% of cases, these behaviours are little more than a tactic to throw you off track, make you vulnerable, and increase your perception of their power. The remaining 5% involve either nasty bullies or parties with so much power and influence that they really don't care about playing hardball because they know they have plenty of alternatives waiting in the wings. Challenging behaviour can result in negative implications for your deal, particularly if you are unprepared for them or intimidated by them. I have dedicated a whole section of this book, Part 4, to understanding and dealing with obstacles. If you encounter these kinds of behaviours and they pose a problem for you, take a detailed look at those chapters. You can often minimise these behaviours or tactics by preempting them and planning in advance how you are going to respond. Thinking about why they feel the need to behave this way, it is often a direct result of trying to mask or deflect from inadequacies. Ignoring them, it often takes the wind out of their sails. Calling them out, the alternative to the previous tip, sometimes this can deflate the challenging behaviour completely. A clever negotiator knows that maintaining a cool, calm and confident edge during deals can help you remain in control no matter what your counterparty throws at you. Remember, By being in charge of your negotiation, you can help to steer it more effectively to where you need it to end. If you don't lead, guess what? They will. And the direction of their steer will, of course, be very much in their favour. Final points before you move on. Have you developed a strategy for dealing with your nerves? Are you and your counterparty working to a joint agenda? Are you utilising the deal sheet? Nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. Have you suggested using the holding pen? Do you have a designated diplomat for climate control? Are you in charge of time? Have you planned how you will deal with challenging behaviour? Chapter 7. Seal. The handshake is often just the start. The final phase of the deals method is how to effectively seal the deal. A great many people fall into the trap of thinking that the hard work is done and the negotiation is over once you sign on the dotted line or shake hands. Wrong. In my experience, some of the most complex aspects of a negotiation take place after a deal has been agreed. It is essential that the deal you do is constructed in such a way that it protects you and your interests post-agreement. You need to ensure that you have given yourself room to review and exit in case of poor performance or non-delivery, or to renegotiate terms in case of a change in circumstance or requirement. Near-end summary. As you approach the end of a negotiation, it is essential that you don't drown in complexity and detail. Clarity is key as the close of a deal draws near, because this is the point at which any misunderstandings or differences of opinion are likely to rear up, since each side realises they are running out of chances to lock in everything that they need. As it starts to become clear that a deal isn't far off, a wise tactic is to summarise the deal as it currently stands from your perspective. By doing this, you can remind people of how far you have come. See Chapter 6 on why this is useful. And you can signal to the other side any areas where agreement still eludes you. Once any outstanding issues have been addressed, do make sure that you summarise again right before deal closure. You want to be absolutely certain that you have fully understood the deal in its entirety. To avoid the potential of any later confusion or pushback, ask your counterparty if this is also their understanding of the deal as it stands. You should only shake hands when you are fully satisfied that you have reached an agreement on every single issue on the table. Congratulations! We have a deal! Or do we? Post-deal, pre-paperwork. There will often be a period of time between the agreement of a deal, as marked by the shaking of hands, and the signing of formal contracts. If not managed correctly, this is the period of time when you could start to see the deal you thought you had agreed being eroded, chipped away at, or potentially changed beyond all recognition. It's also a time in which many people are unclear about both their personal rights and, from a corporate perspective, the enforceability of the deal they have just finalised. The rules governing whether or not your handshake or verbal agreement is binding will vary depending on the legal jurisdiction in which you are operating, the type of product or service you have just purchased or sold, or the nature of the negotiation you have just completed. To check this, as an individual, a good place to research your position would be a consumer rights or consumer law website. For a corporation involved in a negotiation with significant operational, financial and reputational implications, you would be wise to seek advice from the relevant regional legal counsel. Is a handshake legally binding? It depends. Whether or not a handshake is considered legally binding will vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. However, it is worth recognising that in many parts of the world, it is the specificity of the agreement that is likely to influence a judge. That is the subject of the discussion vague, or is it crystal clear what each side was referring to and on what terms? Did each party have the intention to create a legally binding contract, and can this be evidenced in any way? To help solidify the deal, bear the following tips in mind. Consider having each side sign a written agreement in principle document as a precursor to the formal contract. Ensure a handshake or verbal agreement is witnessed by a third party. Agree a defined time period during which each side can come back and query or challenge what has been agreed. Arrange for the parties to maintain contact between the close of the deal and contract signature to keep the relationship on the right track. Be mindful of criticising your counterparty and the deal in public before the contract is signed. Be cautious of overly celebrating your victory if you have just secured the deal of a lifetime. You don't want them to start to feel that the deal is one they might want to back out of. Future-proofing the deal. When you are finalising the agreement, make sure to future-proof it. In the excitement of closing a deal which means a lot to you or your company, you may find that the last thing you want to think about is the deal failing, one side not delivering to a required standard, or the two sides just not working well together. However, this is exactly when you should be thinking about failure. Your formal agreement should incorporate a number of protections and safety nets, just in case things do go sour. Even if the agreed deal doesn't break down catastrophically, these safety nets will help maintain the relationship because everyone is clear about where they stand and what is expected of them. Clear and succinct. Make sure that the terms of your agreement are clear and succinct to avoid confusion or doubt. Try not to overcomplicate the agreement with jargon and convoluted language, and make sure that representatives on both sides are involved in approving and signing off any final contract, memorandum, or deal summary. You want to avoid either side claiming they didn't know what they were signing up to, or that you had unrealistic expectations if the deal starts to face problems. Make sure that the agreement includes clear guidance in relation to performance indicators, escalation procedures, trigger points, and what is deemed to be acceptable or unacceptable conduct. You should leave no room for doubt as to what success and failure look like and how you will jointly approach dealing with bumps in the road or failure. Regular review. Your agreement should also include the requirement for regular review, both informal and formal. Informal review might be a commitment to speak on the phone on a regular, defined basis to discuss progress. Formal review might mean quarterly governance meetings that appraise the whole deal and address bigger or strategic challenges that present themselves. The point is, make sure that the lines of communication between the parties in the deal remain open and accessible. If you regularly share information, you'll be far better prepared to anticipate any major problems on the horizon. Things change. If your deal is an ongoing one or covers a period of multiple years, you should incorporate terms that allow for renegotiation of key aspects of the deal, either at a set point in time, for example, 2 years into a 4-year deal, or triggered by certain situations, for example, interest rates hitting a defined point or the introduction of new technology. The fact is that things change, and your deal needs to have the flexibility to move with the times. A deal that you agreed 2 years ago might have made a lot of sense at the time, but now that things have changed in your business, your supply chain, or politically, the deal has become damaging or unsustainable for you. Some people will always want to retain an element of certainty in the deals they agree to and will resist this approach. Of course, some businesses make their profit by creating deals that take advantage of an accurate prediction of changes in markets or in their counterparty's situation. It might not be in their interests to include an element of flexibility or review in the deal, as they might want to be locked into a situation that is extremely profitable for them. Or they simply might not want to have to renegotiate all of their major agreements every few years. Make sure you explore this before you get to the final sign-off stages of your deal. Ideally, you should be considering issues like flexibility and contract review terms way back in the discover and establish phases. Mediation clauses. It may be prudent for you to include mediation clauses in your final agreement, should a dispute arise. This could be particularly helpful if you are engaged in a longer-term relationship with your counterparty and would like that to continue. The introduction of a third-party mediator can allow you to address contentious or challenging performance or compliance issues without the two sides becoming bogged down in he said, she said disputes or behaving in ways they might later regret. The inclusion of a mediation or dispute resolution clause should not be seen as a failure or a negative step. Instead, it should be viewed as a sensible and pragmatic approach to preserving the health of the future relationship. Deal or no deal? Up to now, we have been talking mainly about scenarios where the outcome is an agreement between the parties. But as we explored right back at the start of the book, sometimes an agreement just cannot be reached and you hit a deadlock. This might come in the form of a reactive standoff because the parties have clashed with each other, relations have been damaged, and there are issues on which people keep getting frustrated and stuck. Or it might be the result of a proactive decision to decide there is no deal to be done. Perhaps this is because the numbers don't add up, the timing isn't right, or the parties have decided to pursue other alternatives. Deadlock and failure. We must remember that our not reaching an agreement, whether because of inability or decision, is not always a negative thing. It's not always a failure. Sometimes it is the logical or prudent answer based on the point we have got to, or the simple facts we have in front of us. As we considered in Chapter 1, it can be far worse to agree to a deal out of fear of deadlock than it is to cut your losses and walk away. We explored in Common Negotiation Mistake 15 that we tend to equate yes with success, but that, quite simply, it isn't always true. Your job as a negotiator is to be clear on your definitions of success and failure, to have explored all of the options and to know at what point a deal just isn't viable. At that point, if you need to and are able to, you should consider walking away. If, however, you feel that you want to try to save the negotiation because you think there is a great deal to be done that you just haven't got to yet, you can try the following tips. Take a time out. Present new proposals. Change the parties. Suggest you reconvene on new terms. Escalate to a higher authority, such as your boss. Leave the door open. Even if you think there is no going back and the deal is off, you never know what a few days to cool off might do. Part 3. People negotiate with people. Chapter 8. The balance of power. Power is one of the most important factors that can influence the outcome of a negotiation. Who has it, who hangs on to it, who uses it, and how they use it should be key considerations for anyone involved in planning for an impending negotiation. We are going to look at some ways to effectively negotiate with someone who has far more power than you, as well as how to negotiate with someone who has far less power than you. Before we do that, we need to explore in a bit more detail the complexities and realities of power, and how we can start to think about it a bit differently. The gift of power bias. In our negotiations, the other side has all the power. They are bigger than us, have more money than us, and have plenty of other people they could go to in order to get what they need. This means we are losing from the start. Our industry is 100% a buyer's market. Our customers hold all the cards. What are we